Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Data, analytics, big data science, machine learning, customer insight, behavioral science, blockchain, data ops, data engineering, agile working. Phew, too many terms, too many things to think about. Do you as a leader need somewhere to turn? To hear what other leaders are doing? To hear what really makes a difference in your business? Welcome. The Customer Insight Leader Podcast is here for you. Each episode, we'll be interviewing a different leader in the fields of customer insight, data, and analytics to hear what they really do, what really makes a difference. So settle down, get that cup of coffee, and enjoy the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast, a place to hear from today's leaders in the fields of customer insight, data science, and analytics. I'm your host, Paul Loughlin, and with me today is Laura Rogers. Laura is Head of Performance Insights for NatWest Group, one of the major banks here in the UK. She's worked within Royal Bank of Scotland, which became part of NatWest Group for over 16 years now, holding management roles responsible for data and a wide range of business intelligence reporting services. She's an accomplished senior data professional with extensive experience of leading and developing high-performing global teams. She's also described herself as passionate about championing diversity and inclusion within the data and technology communities. So I thought with that perspective and experience and the opportunity to hear from the voice of the BI community for a change on this podcast, she'd be a great guest. Welcome, Laura.
Good morning. Thank you, Paul.
You're very
delighted
welcome
to be here with you today.
Oh, good. That's good to hear. We've known each other for a while now through some data leader meetups in Scotland and the great job that MBM Recruitment do there in bringing people together. So it is a delight to finally have you on the podcast, Laura.
Thank you.
Anyway, you've probably heard with my other guests, I like to kick us off by asking my guests to tell us their backstory, if you like, the sort of history of their career, how they got to where they are today. Just so listeners and I know where you're coming from and the experience you're drawing on. So could you tell us, Laura, a bit about your background and how you got into the world of data and reporting?
Yes, absolutely. Delighted to share that, Paul. And I suppose if I look really far back to when I was a young girl, I've always had an interest in data and numbers and probably didn't know it was data at the time, if I'm being honest, but it was I guess, natural curiosity of wanting to look at things, look for patterns, whether that's, you know, was counting the colours of cars that you see on a journey, or I was a huge fan of the Eurovision Song Contest as a child and, you know, used to write down the scores as they came out and try to spot the patterns or predict who was going to win in the future years as well.
Brilliant. I've loved it over the years too. It's a great data source.
Perfect. So I've just really, I suppose, had that natural curiosity and love of all things data numbers. And certainly growing up in the 80s, it wasn't a career that would ever have been considered or spoken about. But there was obviously something there from that early age. And I probably coupled that with just always being quite, perhaps not ambitious, but always quite independent and wanted to do well for myself and just be sort of independent growing up and making your way in life. So fired through school and again, got to that sort of age at 16, which is a little bit younger in Scotland than I think it is in the rest of the UK. Maths and computer science was definitely my area of kind of, or where I did best, I guess, at school. So not quite sure what I wanted to do. Left school and went to university and studied a degree in maths. So went to Strathclyde Uni and I suppose really did that because I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, whether that would be accountancy or actuarial or teaching or technology was probably just sort of starting at that point. It wasn't a career that many people would have known about or done at that time, so it was definitely in the back of my mind but not a prevalent career choice at the time. So did my degree in maths, thoroughly enjoyed it, and got to the end of that and thought, still don't know what I want to do. But then chose to do a postgraduate in systems analysis and design. I think today it might be called computer science, but in the early 2000s, it was definitely systems analysis and design. So did that for a year. And before I'd actually finished that, I'd secured a role as a data engineer at RBS. So started there and worked on sort of technical solutions for pension schemes at the time.
Right.
And started my career that way. So spent a bit of time as a data engineer, which I thoroughly loved. And that's probably my roots, if you like, in terms of my technical background.
Yeah.
Moved on to do some web development as well. So I guess just trying to really get a good understanding and a good knowledge of the whole end-to-end data development process. So really from that data engineering to then being able to visualize the data that you've got and the results that you want to see. Spent a bit of time as a sort of BI analyst as well, which I thoroughly enjoyed, just getting out, meeting our customers, finding out what their problems were and designing solutions that we could use data and technology to help with as well. So did a bit of project management, because that seemed to be, if you were a technologist and you wanted to progress in an organization, you had to do a bit of project management.
Yeah.
Did that as well. And then really from there went on to lead teams of data professionals. So spent a bit of time leading BI teams. And now, as you said earlier, I head up performance insights for NatWest. And I've got a team of data scientists, data engineers, software engineers, BI developers, robotics teams, and an analytic community as well. So I definitely just, my real passion in life is people and data. So looking at my role today, you know, I lead a large team, which is brilliant, and covers every sort of discipline of data, really. So some may say the perfect role.
Lovely. That's great to hear. Always good when people feel that positive about their roles, and it's something they can enjoy excelling in. So tell us a bit more about how complete this data team is. That I may have picked up the wrong end of the stick in thinking of Performance Insights as much more focused on the kind of BI and reporting side. What other parts that people might not think is part of a Performance Insights teams are part of what you're leading at the moment there?
Yeah, no, it's a really great question, Paul. And I think people think about sort of reporting and just see the end product. But as we know, there's the end product's the last probably 10, 15% of any of these programs as well. And I would say in that way, so my team are responsible for providing the performance reporting for all of the parts of NatWest, so whether that's our commercial bank, our retail bank, our wealth bank, or indeed just the running of the sort of functions and services teams within sort of the kind of head office construct. And we try to partner really closely with our customers, and I think for me it's not just about designing, you know, taking a request and designing a report and sending that out. For me, it's about really understanding what is the problem that the customer is trying to solve. So what is it they need to know about? What do they need the data for? What are they going to do with it? What actions are they going to drive? What insights are they hoping to get from that? And then going back and really designing what the right solution for that is. So sometimes that might be a dashboard. Sometimes it might be a web application that we build, and you know, you have it on your mobile, and you know, you can interact with it that way. So I think it's very much about what's the problem you're trying to solve. And you know, as with all data projects, probably about 60-70% of it's mining the data, finding the data, bringing the data together, transforming it. And a complex organization like NatWest, you know, as you can imagine, there's hundreds of different data points, data systems, etc. as well. So typically our work would involve, here's the problem we're trying to solve for our customer. We design what that solution could look like, and then you start on the journey of building that. So that can be so our architecture team will be responsible for getting the data that we need, and where does that come from, and how do we build an automated pipe to bring that into our own kind of data infrastructure. We've then got our data engineers that would do the ETL work on that and just get our data ready and prepped to use. And then you've got the building of the front end. And again, that could be a Tableau dashboard. It could be a bespoke web application as well. One of the roles of my team is that we deploy insights to about 12,000 members of staff every day in a really personalized way. So again, we've got our own system for doing that as well. So that's really the kind of different roles in the team and what people do. And again, on top of that, we try to do everything in an automated fashion. So there's nothing worse than having to manually do the same job day in, day out as well. So we have a robotics team that with the use of robotics, we can automate a lot of the repeatable stuff as well and focus on adding real value rather than turning the handle.
That's great, Laura. Thank you for explaining that. I think what I loved hearing that was not just that you'd got such a complete factory, if you like, from the kind of architecture and the data engineering and the analysts and the web app developers and the data visualizers and that kind of piece, but you were clearly able to tell us a clear story. And I could see your thinking about what you've got is driven by an empathy as to the needs of your internal clients. It isn't just sort of theoretically or fiefdom-wise, these functions sit with me. I can see why they provide a value chain, a factory for the needs that you're meeting there internally. That was very compelling. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's one of the dangers that data professionals, I think, can fall into is just because we can do something doesn't mean to say that we should. I say this probably every day in my role. It's great when you see innovation. It's great when you have brilliant ideas. Mm. But if there isn't a need for it, and if there is, if it's not going to drive some sort of change or some sort of action, then I think we have to question why we're doing it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Totally agree, Laura. Well said. I'm interested to dig into, actually, thinking back to earlier in your career story, and thank you again for sharing that with us. Clearly, after the maths degree, you had this kind of postgrad study of systems and systems analysis, and then a number, really, of different IT roles and that time in data engineering that you really valued. A number of the data and analytics leaders that I have on this podcast come from quite diverse backgrounds. You know, some will come from much more of a business background and into technology. Some will come from another kind of new work function and grow into it. Some purely into data analysis. It's only some who come from a more pure IT background and kind of then go on out of that technology and systems understanding into data roles. So I wonder, from your experience, Laura, do you see that broader technology and systems grounding helps you as a data leader? Is it relevant to your role now?
Yeah, I definitely think it is, Paul. And I was really lucky in my early career when I was in the IT world that we were a really, really small team. Right. So as a result of that, I got involved with all aspects of the development life cycle. So, you know, from, I think I said before, like from the sort of understanding what it is we were trying to do to physically building the design to then coding it. We then did the testing. We then did the rollout to customers. Right. We, you know, we partnered with the organization. It was pensions I looked after initially. So it was maybe a population of a couple of hundred people. Again, it was heavily regulated. So you got to spend a bit of time with risk and compliance and those types of areas as well. So I think as a kind of young person starting out in their career, I really did get a brilliant understanding of kind of all aspects of that kind of financial services industry. Yeah. And then from there, you obviously move through those different roles as we talked about. But I think in terms of, for me personally, I'm a great believer in competence breeds confidence. And there's something for me about leading a team where, no, I probably couldn't go and build a system tomorrow. And I probably am not as up to date with the new technology as I should be if I was going to get into that role. But for me, there's a confidence that you get leading a team when actually you kind of know what they're talking about and you know what they're trying to do. And you can sometimes, not terribly often, you can have an idea or you can maybe help somebody get through a kind of technical problem if they have it as well. And then I think for me, I probably suffer quite badly from imposter syndrome. So I always like having in my back pocket, well, if this all goes horribly wrong, I can go back and be a data engineer. There's loads of data engineering jobs just now. So.
Oh, that's I will resist my coach hat coming on and talking to you about imposter syndrome. It's true for the vast majority of leaders, Laura. That's great. I like that competence breeds confidence. So it's interesting because I think you hint at a kind of balance that leaders need to strike between, I know some who've gone too far to the extreme of competence means I've got to still be able to be hands-on, and they tend to fall into the temptation of micromanaging. And then there's others who it's just about confidence and blagging it all the time, and I could go and run any team. And there's some truth in that, but not always. And I think you're right. There is a kind of middle position where, at least within your career, you've gone deep enough that you get it. You can think yeah. that way. You're not as up to date or as detailed in your understanding as the people who work for you, and you respect that, but they know that you get the concepts and you talk their language. Is that kind of what you're alluding to, Laura?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for me, it's really important with the team that you have around you as well. So my direct leadership team are extremely diverse. And right. And when I say diverse, I mean that diversity of thinking and diversity of background. And,
yes.
you know, everybody brings something different. And I think it's about, you need to respect and appreciate the differences that people bring. And yes. just because you lead the team doesn't mean to say that you know you're the expert in it all, if indeed the expert in anything. I don't think, I certainly am not, but you know, that's where you have your experts in the team, and you really can pull together and work as a team. And and I think just having the background that I've got, and a genuine like real interest and care for the people that work for me, I think that breeds a respect within your team as well, so people are more willing to help you and, you know, be patient with my daft questions and things like that as well. So I definitely do think that helps.
Yes, yes. Powerful the leader who's willing to let themselves ask daft questions.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's follow up on that aspect of kind of empathy and care for people, because I completely get respect is, I totally agree, built by both competence and care. And it's kind of come through a number of things that you've said. You clearly enjoy talking to stakeholders and getting out there and helping people and understanding what they need. And I know when we've chatted before, it's become clear that you kind of on your career discovered that you were maybe a little bit better at this than some of your other introverted colleagues in the technical areas that you've worked in. I wonder, mastering that or discovering that that was your forte a bit more, do you think that supercharged your career into kind of data leadership roles? And as a corollary, is it just that you can do it, or do you know how you do it so that you can actually encourage maybe shy analysts who work for you to also develop those stakeholder management, those empathy, those communication skills? Sorry, there's a lot in that, Laura.
No, you can keep me right if I forget parts of the question.
Okay,
Paul,
yeah, sorry, too much in the question, my fault.
No, you're fine. I think you're right. I think typically data people tend to be quite introverted and quite shy, and I realise that's a real broad sweeping statement, and it doesn't apply to everybody, but in my experience, certainly, more generally, people are quite introverted. And I think sometimes in organisations it can be quite hard to get on if that's the case. Like, you might be brilliant at what you're doing, but if nobody sees you and you don't build up that sort of advocacy and support and that sort of network, it can be quite difficult. And I think for those that are perhaps not as introverted and not as shy, then you tend to sometimes just kind of get thrown into those sort of positions and those sort of roles. But I definitely think, looking back on it, they're really different things. You know, being a real expert in your technical field and then moving into sort of leading those teams, it's a really different skill set. And I don't think, you know, I certainly wandered into it probably without thinking about it or realizing what you were getting into. So I definitely think, you know, being a little bit more extrovert, if that's what I would call myself, I'm not actually sure that I would, to be honest, but it is something very different, and I think it's something you have to work at as well. So I've really, really had to work on my confidence, and I think just that self-belief as well, and it doesn't come naturally to me, and it's been a really difficult journey. But I think just the more you do these things and the more time you spend pushing yourself and just being, I guess you've got to learn to be comfortable with the uncomfortable, haven't you? And just keep trying to push and progress yourself as well. And probably if you'd asked me to do this podcast 5 years ago, I just wouldn't have had the confidence to do it. Right. So, I mean, I can see a difference in my own sort of skills and confidence levels as well.
That's great to hear. Well, you're very eloquent on the podcast, Laura, so you're quite right to have come on. I'm interested, it's very interesting to me, and it might just be the geeky coach in me, but that you touch on confidence is such a part of this. It isn't just empathy for your stakeholders, communication skills, stakeholder management, understanding kind of thing. There's a confidence to be that sort of extrovert, at least in the type of behaviours. I wonder, in building that confidence, Laura, can you think of any particular things that you've kept doing that have helped, particularly any that you've then been able to recommend others do as well? So that's helped them with that confidence building.
Yeah, there was. I had the opportunity to work with a coach within the organisation a couple of years ago. And it was just a really simple tip that she gave me. And it's something that I still use. And this for me was really about, when we talk about confidence, for me it's that, I don't even know if confidence is the right word, but it's the inner self-belief in what you're doing. It's okay. Believing that actually I can do this and I'm quite good at it. And that's something that's normally really uncomfortable to say. Or it certainly was for me. But one of the things that she, it was almost like a really simple exercise. This was back when we were in the office probably 5 days a week and I had about an hour's commute every night on the way home. And she said, when you're in that car at night, just take 10 minutes before you put the radio on and before you start listening to your music or a podcast or whatever it is, and just think about what are the three things that you did well today. And that could be delivering something. It could be just that conversation you had with your member of staff that was struggling. It could be that nice bit of feedback that you got. Just focus on three positive things that have happened that day.
Yeah.
Don't worry about the 15 things that you didn't get to on your to-do list or that thing that went wrong.
Yeah.
But just think about those three things, acknowledge what they are, and then think about, well, why were they good? What did I do to make that good? And what are the skills that I've brought to that as well? And it was a really simple thing, but just grounding yourself back to, my day might have felt really horrible and a bit of a disaster, but you can always find a few things. Even if it's buying somebody a coffee, you can always find those few things that you did that was nice, made you feel good.
Yes.
And for me, that really did help build that confidence. And then the other thing that we worked on was a bit about that brand. So what do you want to be known for? So we spent a lot of time thinking about what do you want people to say about you and testing it with what people did say. And sometimes, do you know sometimes when you ask for feedback and you get something back and you're like, well, yeah, it's nice that you think I'm nice, but actually that really wasn't what I was going for.
Yes.
So we spent a bit of time looking at what are the bits of feedback that you don't want people to say about you, and how do you almost overmanage not having that as feedback. And then the last thing I'd probably say in terms of practical things, Paul, is on one of the sort of coaching sessions we were at, a lady just left a statement with me, and you probably heard it before, but if not you, then who? And if not now, then when? And again, as opportunities come along, or you're kind of at that, well, I don't know if I can do this, or I'm a bit scared to go for that, I always come back to that phrase and think, well, how would I feel if it was my colleague that did it because I said I couldn't do it or I wouldn't do it? And just that makes me push myself forward as well.
That's great, Laura. Thank you. So simple and practical. And I've definitely heard others who benefit. I can remember years ago hearing a guy called Michael Hyatt share a lot about at the end of the day, always reflecting on the day's wins and talking them over with his wife in that case. I think those kind of exercises, just like gratitude exercises, they can be very effective. And I like the reminder of if not you, who, and if not now, when. That's brilliant. Okay, another thing I'd like to focus on is, I mentioned before, it is great to hear how much you love your role. That is really good. It's what the coaches want out of their clients. It's what people like to hear as well. But I can imagine some people with different data careers or data science career kind of aspirations still sort of thinking, what's so great about reporting? Yes, Laura's got a more complete solution, a more complete kind of factory to deliver a variety of output. And that sounds a bit more interesting than just a BI team. But why is your role and the work of your team more interesting than listeners might imagine? When I think some people discount a career in the kind of reporting areas.
think that's a really good question. And it possibly comes down to the fact that I'm a little bit nosy. So data's...
What a great answer.
data without a purpose doesn't really mean anything. So I personally, and this will not be the views of everybody, personally, I can think of nothing worse than working on a big data set or building a model or doing whatever it is you do and actually not knowing why. So why are we doing this? Yes. What's the purpose of it? And what's somebody going to do with this information? So for me, and I think I'm really fortunate because, you know, my team aren't just a reporting team. You know, we do modeling, and we visualize those models as well. So we build tools that allow you to interact and to, you know, what happens if we did this? What would it mean for why? And we can bring that to life and tell the story as well. So for me, it's really about understanding the data and, like, the so what. That's just the most fascinating thing for me is we've got all these numbers and what's, like, a bit of a detective. Yes. What's the story? What are we trying to find? How can we help add value to our organization by diving into that data? And I think with our team, with it sort of being that multidisciplinary, is we bring together squads as well. So rarely as a data engineer will you work on your own without seeing, like, what the front end's going to look like or what the customers are going to do with it. So it's that kind of completeness that brings it all together, and you feel like you're part of something, you're part of a project, part of a story, and part of a solution.
Yes. Yeah, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. Let me just pause for a moment to say I apologize to listeners and to you, Laura. My neighbor seems to have decided that now is the time to trim everything that moves in his garden. So I'm hoping with the editing I can reduce the background noise, but if you're hearing some of it, I can only apologize.
No problem at all.
Laura, coming back to that, and I think it's great. There's two things, I guess, that struck me there. One, that whole tie into relevance absolutely echoes. I can think of a number of colleagues I know who have worked in kind of database marketing areas or decisioning areas. And it's the same sort of motivation that they talk about. The technical work that they do, they can really see the difference and ideally even the financial return or the improved customer experience that kind of comes about as a result. I think that is key to roles being motivational and enjoyable. But it is also, I guess, back again to this, you do bring together a more diverse range of skills, a more interesting variety of technical solutions than I've often heard under the broad banner of reporting. Tell us a bit more how modeling comes into it, because I think a lot of people, and this is partly the whole successful PR that data science suddenly created things that had existed before, but a lot of people wouldn't think that kind of predictive modeling or deeper statistical work would happen within a reporting team, even if they could sort of get their heads around some of the other functions you've mentioned. So without betraying any confidence, obviously, what causes you to do modeling work, and how do you maintain that skill set in a reporting team?
So again, I think it comes back to, if you were looking at what soft skill does that tie back to, and for me, that's curiosity, Paul. So in terms of if you're telling a story about some data that you have, so rather than me speaking about financial stuff, let me speak about the Eurovision Song Contest. So when I used to gather all my stats together, I'd put it in a little spreadsheet and we could see the UK got 0 points again, France got 30. who did France get them from? You know, so you can tell the story of what's happened, and it's relatively interesting. You know, somebody might be interested, and, you know, fair enough. Then you might say, well, actually, is that a trend? Does the UK always get 0 points, or do Ireland always give them 12 points? So you can start to then go back and look for those patterns. And then I think the more interesting bit, and I'm being slightly flippant using Eurovision Song Contest, but you then get to the, I wonder what's going to happen next year. I wonder, you know, like, could we start to maybe predict and see, well, actually, what's going to happen in the future? So I think reporting, you make a mistake if you just do the look back. I think you then need to do the look forward and what do we think could happen? And also the, you know, I talked a little bit about actionable insight. So it's having the data there that then can influence what you might do going forward. So actually, if the bank did this particular thing, what would the impact be on X or Y? And I think that's where you just get that full suite coming together. So it's about reporting the story, but not just looking back, but the possibilities. What are your recommendations, and having data to back those recommendations up, and then what could that look like in the future as well? So for me, it's just that curiosity and just the questions that you would ask yourself.
Yeah, great answer. I guess it strikes me almost that what you're describing is not just your performance insights team, and I must use that name rather than constantly labeling you just reporting because there's so much more, but it's not just then predictive analytics, you're kind of prescriptive analytics, if I'm understanding correctly, because you're bringing to the party not just some predictive modeling, but also the business understanding, the consideration of the action that's needed and some recommended actions. Would you see that as what you're providing, prescriptive analytics as well?
A little bit. I think it's the area that we probably need to start thinking about a little bit more. So we probably don't do enough of it at the moment. But I think there's definitely an opportunity there.
Great. Okay. Well, let's turn to the other thing that I gave you some billing for at the beginning, because I know it's a passion of yours, the work on diversity. And I was pleased to hear earlier that you've got the consideration of cognitive diversity as well. It isn't just appearance and background. It's also people thinking differently and teams that can help each other in that way. But I know one thing is that you've done a little bit more work on is neurodiversity in teams. Now, some of the previous people I've had on the podcast have done some great work on things like gender balance in teams and those kind of focuses, the diversity. But I don't think on the podcast before we've really discussed neurodiversity. And I know it can be a challenging topic, even if people sometimes say the right things. In terms of data leaders thinking in their hiring, I know some who, at least behind closed doors, might confess they're a bit nervous about hiring neurodiverse people. What have you learned about how to recognize and hire the right neurodiverse people who really have got the potential and the skills, and particularly how to set them up for success and not maybe disrupt existing teams? What do people need to consider, and what helps this be a success, Laura?
I think it's a great question, Paula, and I think you're right. I think there is in generally a nervousness about doing the right thing, saying the right thing, not upsetting anybody, etc. And I think it is challenging, but I suppose what I would say, and I would apply this to all 170 people in my team, it's knowing the person. So actually, it shouldn't. I don't think you need to have a label. And when you have that number of people from different backgrounds, different ethnicities, different gender, different different neurodiversity as well.
Yeah.
Everybody's just an individual, and everybody, I believe, comes to work to do the very best job that they can do. And I think my job as a leader is, how do I enable them and create the environment and the culture that they can come to work and they can really thrive and develop their skills? And for me, that's really about knowing your people and speaking to your people as well and asking them. So we partnered with a consultancy firm a few years ago that helps place neurodiverse people into the workplace.
Okay.
Normally just as a contract to start with, but
we've
been fortunate enough to have one of the individuals come and join us as a full-time member of staff.
Really? Good.
And I think that, at the start there was sort of, things we had to put in place to help this individual come in and feel settled within the team. But like, why wouldn't you do that? So it was very much about speaking to them, speaking to the support they had at the time and saying, what are the things that we need to consider? And it might just have been things like, don't spring a conversation on the individual. So can we give them warning that we're maybe going to speak to them, or we want to ask them something, or they're not comfortable doing this type of thing. Well, we just won't ask you to do that type of thing. I think it's very much a personal thing and speaking to people. And I think just acknowledging that everybody has something to bring and something to give to an organisation. And from what I've seen with our neurodiverse individuals in the team, the way that their minds work is so logical and so analytical. It is absolutely perfect for some of the projects that we need to do. If you're rewriting code, improving code, automating code, whatever it might be, that their minds are just brilliant for it. So, we have to appreciate those differences and allow people to play to their strengths. I think sometimes in an organization, when you have your development chats, it's right, what are you not very good at and how do we make you better at it? I prefer to say, right, okay, what is it you do brilliantly and how do we get you to do more of that? Because that's obviously what you enjoy. It's where you're adding value. Yeah, there'll be some things maybe you're not brilliant at, but you're not going to be brilliant at everything. So let's just play to people's strengths and help them develop them as well.
Yeah, that makes good sense, Laura. Thank you. And I think it's interesting that you share the sort of scale of your team, because I know I've increasingly discovered, both in people I led and those I work with, how many people within the data and analytics community actually are, to take just one dimension, on the autism spectrum. And it's not, yeah, not as rare as it would be in the wider population, I don't think. I think there's a skew, yeah, toward people in that situation being suited to these kind of careers. But when I talk with people who have had that diagnosis, it's not uncommon that they might find it challenging to engage with stakeholders. They might find sometimes that some of the social interactions in teams are a bit challenging as well. I wonder if there's anything you've learned as you've gone along, maybe working with the consultancy or working with individuals, that you didn't know before, that by listening to individuals, and I hear you on that, absolutely, Laura, you've learned, actually, I might not have guessed this before, but changing this about the way we work, or giving this freedom, or adapting in this way, actually proved to be really helpful in that interpersonal area that can be a bit more difficult for people who, well, for some people who are neurodiverse.
A good question, Paul. And I suppose probably where I'm, why I'm hesitating slightly is that everybody's different. So I don't think I've got a kind of one answer to suit the thing. But if I can share a bit of a story with you, actually, when we brought our individual on from the consultancy that we were working with, he was very, very quiet, didn't really interact with anybody in the team, but he was really happy what he was doing and delivering for us, but didn't really interact with the team. At the end of the 6 months, when he left us, initially he did come back, he was organising teams coffee mornings. This was during lockdown. He was organising team chats for his immediate team, actually putting them in the diary, setting them up, hosting them, inviting people along, setting the kind of the loose agenda. So I think what probably, and again, this is maybe quite obvious, but just because somebody feels a certain way at one part, they do develop and people change and people move on and their confidence grows as well. So I think it's, you know, you can't pigeonhole people until, you know, they don't like speaking to people, so that'll never change. It does change. And I think for me, it's about creating the environment, which is so important, that they feel they can grow, they can be part of something, and that they're supported to be themselves and to try and help them as well. So for me, that's, you know, these are the reasons why you get up and do your job in the morning, is when you can see people developing, seeing them grow, and just seeing them thriving. You know, these are the things. It's lovely to build a nice dashboard and have great customer feedback, but it's seeing the impact you have on people's day-to-day lives that really get me out of bed in the morning.
That's brilliant, Laura, brilliant. And I completely hear that. And actually hearing you say that reminds me that I can think of individuals who, because they're in a supportive environment and because they were given feedback, even sometimes quite challenging feedback, that they did develop into skills that people might not have thought could ever be them. So I think you're right. We shouldn't reduce people down to a label of, we need to protect them from certain parts of the role because they could never do it. That's not necessarily true. I always try and protect some time on our podcast, and I could talk to you for hours, Laura, but it wouldn't really be fair to the listeners. I try and protect some time for people who are early in the career, because when I've done a bit of analysis on listeners to the podcast, we're about a 50-50 split between those who are more senior, maybe at the same sort of level as you, and those who are earlier in their career tend to be interested in hearing these stories as well. For those who are earlier in their career, and maybe they're considering roles in data or reporting or insight, what skills would you say will set them up for success? What skills would you encourage them to start developing now?
Well, that's a good question. So I would definitely say to anybody, definitely take a career in data. It's the hottest career in the market just now, loads of jobs. And again, I think it's one of these areas that's just never going to go away, is that you can't imagine a world in the future without data being at the heart of what you do. So I would definitely say take up that data role. I think from a technical perspective, don't try and learn everything. sometimes I'll have conversations with people and what are you focusing on? I'm going to learn Python, I'm going to learn SQL, I'm going to learn Tableau, and then I'm going to learn a bit of machine learning. Right, okay, that you're never going to do all that. So I would say, like, almost data is such a big general subject. So really do your homework, find what's the area that interests you most. Try and maybe get a bit of experience in it as well. Like, you might think data engineering is for you, but, you know, let's try and see if you can get a bit of experience doing that as well.
Yeah.
And then I would say pick, you know, coding languages change all the time. And as technology moves on, there's always a new thing around the corner. So I would try and say get something that's a really good grounding. So whether that's SQL or Python or whatever it is, you know, try and get a really good coding language. And once you learn one, I think it sets you up for, you know, for future ones as well.
Yeah.
And then do something you're good at. Like, there can be nothing worse than starting a career and you don't enjoy it. So pick something that you like and that you're good at as well. And you'll get on much better and it'll be much easier for you as well. I would say get a mentor. So when you start, if you're starting your career, definitely valuable to get a mentor, ideally not your line manager, and ideally somebody maybe a little bit removed from the work that you do day to day, and just get yourself that mentor. And then, so probably two more things, I would say be curious, so ask the questions, take the opportunities as they're presented to you, you know, just push yourself to do that and to take those up as well. And then lastly, just have belief in yourself. You know, everybody brings something and everybody has value to give and value to contribute. So just believe in yourself as well.
Great.
That doesn't sound too cheesy.
not at all, Laura. It comes across as very genuine. So thank you for sharing it. That has been brilliant, Laura. Thanks for your thoughts and many thanks for your time today. As I thought it would be, it's been a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you so much, Paul. I really enjoyed that. And as you say, we could have chatted all afternoon, but thank you very much. I really enjoyed that.
Good. You're very welcome. Thank you also, listeners, for listening. I hope you found that helpful and continue to listen to the Customer Insight Leader podcasts. More great interviews coming up. And each week there's also fresh content on our blog at customerinsightleader.com. So you might want to check that out too. Before then, it just reminds me to say thank you to everyone for your time, apart from the person trimming the hedge nearby. And have a great week and perhaps reflect on, to me, two of the themes that really came out talking to Laura, that empathy for others and that curiosity and in things like the way that she really understood the needs of the organization and how the different technical functions came together to meet that need, or in the way of engaging and really getting the best out of a neurodiverse community within her workforce as well. What is it for you where you could bring more empathy and more curiosity to bear in your role to help improve in those kind of areas? Anyway, that's enough thought for the day from me. Bye for now.